Welcome to the Corporate Venturing Insider Series, where I interview top practitioners in the CVC world and learn with you the best practices and golden nuggets that they have accumulated over their careers. Today, we are proud to announce our 100th episode with interviewee Jeff Buskam. He is general partner and co-founder of Flybridge Capital Partners, senior lecturer at Harvard Business School, and author of the new book, The Experimentation Machine. I spoke with Jeff back in February 2025, and it was an amazing conversation full of several golden nuggets. Jeff, could you take a few minutes to share your story and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. I was a computer nerd as a kid in the 1980s. I was one of those kids that got an Apple II Plus when it came out and the PET Commodore, taught myself how to program, BASIC, Fortran, all those fun things. I was a computer science undergrad at Harvard and thought that I would perhaps go into tech entrepreneurship. And so I went to BCG for a couple of years to learn business and then went back to Harvard Business School to round out my business education. And then I jumped into the startup ecosystem. I jumped into startup land right out of HBS in 1995. I joined an internet software company back when there weren't very many internet software companies called Open Market. We went public a year after I joined. I had an amazing five-year journey there as a joiner, joiners being the folks that don't start the company, but come on board like I did when it's 10, 20, 30 employees and then help build the company. And then after 5 years, we went public. We were a couple billion dollar market cap. I left to co-found a company, and that company was called YouPromise, and that had a successful run. And I joined a couple friends who spun out of their venture firms, one out of Greylock in particular. And when the bubble had crashed in 2000, 2001, we thought there was an opportunity to create a new venture capital firm focused on early stage investing in the Northeast. And so that was the founding vision behind Flybridge, which we started in 2002.
All right. So you started with the word geek, and I know you invest in hard tech. How much of the geek in you is helping you to be a good VC in hard tech?
I'm more focused on enterprise software. And yeah, I love playing with tools. When some of the new AI tools come out, I'm always playing around with them. I wrote a chat bot for my HBS course and used retrieval augmentation generation RAG to train it on my corpus and my writings and my books and my cases. I'm always having fun playing around with the new toys. I created an AI clone of myself when the AI clones tools came out, like Delphi.ai, which is where my clone sits.
I'm going to ask you a few questions about how you incorporate some of the tools into what you do. But before that, most people say entrepreneurship is very, very hard. So you're making it sound like so easy. And actually, joining in 95, 1 year later, IPO sounds like the dream scenario, which I don't think happens often. So can you also talk about the entrepreneurship other side and what that means, and what would you say to recommend or not recommend entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I'm glad you point that out, Nicholas, because I have had somewhat of a charm journey in that my two startups were successful. I will say that on the inside, it's a bit like the duck who looks so calm on the water, but is paddling furiously underneath. We had a lot of ups and downs. We almost ran out of money. The product didn't work. We had to reboot the entire code base a month before the IPO. We missed a quarter and the stock price dropped and we had to turn around the company. A couple acquisitions didn't work and we had to spin them off. Like, we had plenty of messy things happen during that journey. And in my company that I co-founded, also many messy things, including navigating the crash of 2000 and 2001. And in my hundreds of investments over my 22-year career as a venture capitalist, I fail more often than I succeed. So I'm very accustomed to the fact that entrepreneurship is very, 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 very hard and is a game that one plays in the context of recognizing that you're entering what I call startup land, where there are multiple rounds at the table. You're stepping up to the poker table or the card table, not just to play one hand, but to play multiple hands over the course of a 20, 30 year career, ideally, and hoping that a few of these hands really play out well. And as an investor, you want to be very respectful of the fact that that entrepreneur has all their eggs in that one basket. And your job, of course, is to help them nurture and protect that basket.
Yeah, I feel like this is a good segue to talk about your book. First, I think Eric Ries, made a very nice comment about your book. He called it the perfect guide for AI area founders. And your book is called The Experimentation Machine. And if you could share what it is about, why people should read it, and maybe give the link where people can pre-order or order, depending on when they watch this podcast.
Yeah, the subtitle is Finding Product Market Fit in the Age of AI. And I think that sort of summarizes it. The experimentation machine is a mindset that Eric Ries started and Steve Blank started with the Lean Startup, and has really now, I think, flourished with the modern AI tools to allow one to experiment even more effectively and efficiently, and leverage the modern AI tools in combination with the timeless value creation strategic methods to find product market fit more rapidly and more effectively. And so that's the essence of the book. You can pre-order it at jeffbusgang.com. When you listen to this, it might already be out and available on Amazon. It's coming out just at the end of February.
And you've built an investment thesis. You call it the third wave. Thinking about you starting in 95, the startup at the time for the internet, that's 30 years ago. How do you define an investment thesis? How do you build an investment thesis?
Great question. And I teach this class at Harvard Business School called Venture Capital Journey, VCJ, which is a class for the students who are aspiring venture capitalists. I've now had a few hundred students go through that class and become VCs out there in the ecosystem. My longstanding course, Launching Tech Ventures, which I've been teaching for 15 years, is a class for early stage pre-product market fit aspiring startup founders. So that over the 15 years, I've taught to 2,500 students. That's been the main focus of my work at Harvard. But this VCJ class, it's given me the space to go deeper on this question, this approach of investment thesis development. And it begins with a hypothesis about the future. And ideally, that's a non-obvious hypothesis at the time. Everything in retrospect is obvious. So today, if I were to say to you, in 1994 and 1995, when I joined my internet startup, my hypothesis for the future was that the internet would be a place where business would be done in a secure, enterprise-wide fashion. Yeah, that's ridiculous, because of course that's an obvious statement, but in 1994, 1995, it was rather controversial, it was rather non-obvious. So here sitting in 2025, the job of the venture capitalist, corporate VC or institutional VC, is to develop these hypotheses about the future that are non-obvious. So you develop a non-obvious hypothesis about the future, and then you go deep and ideally narrow, really narrow, on a manifestation of that hypothesis that you believe will yield tremendous value.
So if it's not obvious, and this is your advantage to have identified something not obvious you believe in, and you believe you would be right, otherwise you wouldn't invest, why share your investment thesis publicly? Don't you want to keep it secret?
That's a great question. And when I first started blogging as a venture capitalist 20 years ago, and in fact, I wrote my first book, Mastering the VC Game, which some folks and listeners may be interested in, and that talks about the VC ecosystem for founders and raising capital. And so to answer your question, the reason people do it like us is that we're in the business of sharing ideas with entrepreneurs in order to attract entrepreneurs. The best investors are always out to find the best entrepreneurs who have a similar hypothesis about the future and a similar view on value creation opportunities. And so if we publish our thesis and there's an entrepreneur out there who reads that and says, that's me, that's what I'm doing, I need to talk to this guy. And so it establishes credibility and also gets the word out there that we have a belief and we want to talk to people who have a similar shared belief about the future.
And I think it's also helping not just to reach out to entrepreneurs, but an effectiveness filter. People will reach out to you is because they resonate with that investment thesis and they already start with the right pitch to you versus one that's totally random for you. Now, you mentioned the value of a public investment thesis for entrepreneurs to know, but I think it's also useful for investors to know, because then they can see if there's a match and overlap of investment interest. And because of the audience, I think it's a good chance for you to share what Flybridge believe in and that investment thesis. So if you could share maybe in 2 minutes, 3 minutes, what your investment thesis is so that if the audience resonates, they can reach out to you.
Yeah, thank you. And the very high level vision we have is that every company is going to be an AI forward company. I say this in my book, in the opening paragraph of the opening chapter. We don't believe that AI is going to replace founders anytime soon, but we think founders who use AI are going to replace founders who don't use AI. So our first principle thinking is we want to invest in AI forward founders, not just AI companies, companies that are building AI products or AI infused products, but also founders who are themselves operating like a 10x founder, just like the mythical 10x developer being 10 times productive using modern development tools. We want to invest in 10x founders. The second principle we have is that the infrastructure layer is being rapidly commoditized, and the launch of DeepSeek and the open source models that are coming out and the rapidly declining price of AI compute and inference that you see, it's a similar pattern to every new technology cycle and wave. So we're super focused on vertical AI forward, vertical SaaS, AI forward tooling and development environments, AI for horizontal applications that replace horizontal functions like interviewing and HR and customer service, applications that look at the jobs of the world that cost $200,000 per person, like legal and accounting and consulting. And we're looking for companies that have a hypothesis about the future and how those jobs could be replaced and supplemented with AI. Yeah. And then the final thing is we believe that every company in the world will hire more AI agents than humans. And so we're looking for next order thinking infrastructure that allows companies to manage thousands and tens of thousands of AI agents in the workforce and have human AI agentic interfaces. And so we're spending a lot of time on, I touched on it earlier, AI managed agentic management tools, authentication, security, orchestration, feedback, quality control, everything that has to do with managing a large AI agentic workforce.
So let me ask maybe a provocative question, but today, annual reports of public company mention how many people they have working for them. Can you imagine 10 years from now where they would also report how many agents do they have working for them?
Yeah, it's a great question. I say this somewhat provocatively in my book. I wonder if we've reached peak employment in the Magnificent Seven, because those companies are the most AI forward in leveraging their own tools, eating their own dog food to be more efficient. And if you look at the last few years, they've grown revenue 20, 30, 40% and kept headcount flat. So one hypothesis is we maybe we've reached peak employment first in the most advanced AI big companies and soon across the entire ecosystem. And then to your point, I think more likely they might report on revenue per employee as a more important metric to show that in our world, can you build a $1 billion company with 100 employees, 50 employees, how about 10 employees? And then as Sam Altman famously said last year, could you imagine a $1 billion company with one employee? So that's, I think, very interesting.
I think that's really interesting. That's the third wave and it's just starting. And I want to move now to CVCs because as an investor, you've worked with CVCs. I'm sure you've seen good ones, maybe not so good ones. How do you think about value creation and your advice to a CVC when thinking of value creation?
I've worked with many CVCs over the many hundreds of companies across our portfolio. And there is a distinct, let's say, segmentation. Many CVCs promise value add above and beyond capital. Only a few deliver. So the real test is, can you be more than just the wire that you send in the bank account? Can you really deliver true insights into the market, real expertise in a particular segment, and most importantly, business development and revenue contracts, openings at least, at bats at least for the sales organization? And if you can really provide those elements of value add, you're a top quartile CVC in my book. And I think the opposite end of the spectrum are CVCs that act, let's say, irrationally. So in our world, we are investing in companies that we know may or may not succeed. And as an investor, you're doing your best to help that company succeed, recognizing though that if it doesn't go well, you want to exit with honor. CVCs that are more risk averse, or maybe lead investor in a corporate VC that's worried about face saving, may push behavior that's not exit with honor. But a CVC I've seen might want to continue playing a few more rounds and extend the pain and push it out another year, another 2 years. We had a portfolio company that was doing well. They continued to raise subsequent rounds of financing. One of the rounds of financing was with a CVC as the lead. After another year or two, it became pretty clear that the company wasn't going to be a rocket ship, that it needed to sell, that the sale price would be 150, 200 million, which was a good outcome for everybody. The CVC would not make a lot of money. They would get their money back, but other people would make money. The founder was going to make money and the seed investors like ourselves were going to make money. But because the CVC came in at a high price, they didn't like the idea of selling and getting their money back. And so they said, we're going to block the sale. And the founder of the board said, what are you talking about? We've all agreed this is the best thing for the company and the best chance that all shareholders have for seeing a reasonable return. And the CVC said, we're going to block the sale unless you give us a 1.25x return. Now that is incredibly pound foolish, penny, you know, wise, because not only did that cause great acrimony and almost blow up the deal, and finally something happened and the deal was negotiated and they were paid off less than 125, I think it was like 110 in the end. Nobody on that cap table will ever work with that CVC.
Yeah, that's it. Blacklisted.
Blacklisted. And whenever we see them talking to founders, we tell the founders this story and we say, you shouldn't work with this firm. So, you know, this is a reputation business. As I said, multiple rounds at the table, and short-sighted behavior can often lead to long-term poor ramifications. And so frankly, I coach a lot of my entrepreneurs if they're going to take on CVC capital, not to allow them to be on the board, but rather have them be as board observers. And there are times when they excuse the board observers and just have a board only session because maybe we're talking about working with a competitor to the CVC as a customer or a partnership or a distribution agreement, or maybe even an M&A transaction. So you really want to create these firewalls between sometimes the CVC, who's going to be more likely to act on their employer's interests, and the company and the board who are bound by fiduciary duty to act in the shareholder interest.
And so what would you recommend when a CVC is on the board, but there's a discussion about engaging with a competitor? Is it for the CVC to excuse themselves? How should the entrepreneur approach it?
The CVC should be proactive in recusing themselves, and the entrepreneur should be proactive in asserting that there should be a recusal and a conversation absent that CVC. And everybody should understand that's the reality of what the situation requires.
Yeah, that's a golden nugget, but this is really, it's beyond best practice. It's a should do. So if you had now, so we talked about all the, maybe not all, but a few select bad practices. Can you share maybe some of the best examples you've seen about CVCs doing something really right?
When I think about best practice and best behavior of CVCs, model behavior, it's usually when the company and the representative acts like a team member, like the VP of business development. And they say, what can I do to help, to give credibility, to open up doors, to affect introductions, to champion the platform, product, service, what have you, in the ecosystem, and just really almost, like I said, view themselves as a part-time VP of business development and isn't afraid to be pushy and open doors. I had one CVC investor who was a relatively small investor in a company when I was a co-founder and executive team member, when I was president of my company, who would go unannounced to the CEO's office and say, you've got to meet with Jeff. What he's working on is important. You've just got to take a meeting. And he wasn't shy about it. He was shameless, frankly. And so that's what we really want to see from the CVCs that are in our cap table and in our boardroom.
Now, I want to talk about the best practices of decision-making of a VC and how it could be applied to a CVC. And clearly, you have your investment committee, you have your decision-making, you probably have some of these best practices you build over time. Which ones do you think are good ones for CVC to think about?
I don't profess to know exactly what's good for a CVC to think about, so I'll just share what we do and maybe your listeners will reflect on how it applies to them. I think the most important thing at Flybridge that we talk about is our style of decision making is high conviction and non-consensus. And so non-consensus, high conviction, highly considered is our mantra. And the reason that's so important, as I said earlier, is that the non-consensus decisions tend to be the best ones. The second thing I would say is nothing kills deals like time. And most competitive deals don't hang around very long.
So I think there is a few golden nuggets, but I think the high conviction, no consensus is strong. But how do you reconcile the prepared mind discipline without succumbing to the FOMO?
One of my partners has a fun phrase that I think of when we get into these moments, which is we don't need to invest in every great deal. We just need the deals that we invest in to be great. So don't chase a deal just because you think it's going to be a great deal. It's got to be in your wheelhouse, in your sweet spot. Now, all that said, we also want to allow ourselves to be open to out-of-the-box ideas, because sometimes the out-of-the-box ideas become the outliers. So there are times when we'll see an outlier. So for example, the company that you and I have invested in together between our two firms, TDK and Flybridge, Glimpse Engineering, that company is in the auto industry and battery industry in terms of its application area. But we are not experts in batteries and EV equipment. We have not invested in auto and EV very frequently. So that was a little out of the box in terms of the specific industry, very much consistent with our prepared mind in terms of approach and application. And it didn't happen in one meeting. It happened after a series of meetings to help us get up to speed on this particular industry. And so if we have in our evaluative process high conviction that the team are outliers, we might be more accommodating on some of the other dimensions and criteria. We also have historically had high conviction that amazing markets will result in great outcomes, even with mediocre teams and mediocre execution. You've seen this time and time again, where an amazing market results in multiple winners and multiple extraordinarily positive outcomes. So if we have such high conviction in the tailwinds behind the market and the secular trend behind the market, maybe we'll compromise a bit. We try not to compromise on team, but maybe we'll compromise on price or traction. So for example, we recently invested in an AI application company, I won't say the name, where we paid a higher price than we might otherwise be comfortable with, because the team is just outstanding, exceptional, extraordinary. And we believe the market is exceptional, outstanding, massive tailwinds. The pricing was higher than the rational investor might allow. But sometimes in our business, you have to know when to pay up for an exceptional team with an exceptional tailwind.
The way I'm thinking of this is, if you're going to invest in what turns out to be a fund returner, whether it's 25x or 50x, paying up is okay, because this is still going to be an outlier and a fund returner.
I think that's right. And I think one of the things we discuss internally is fund returners have become bigger and bigger. When we first invested in MongoDB, we sheepishly thought in our investment thesis, maybe the market size for database software will be 8 billion. And maybe we can get 5-10% of that market. And maybe we can build a multi-$100 million company worth $1 billion or $2 billion. Turns out it's a tens of billions of dollars market. The company's revenue is now north of $2 billion and the valuation is $20 billion. So the outcomes are larger than they ever have been before.
And maybe the last question I would have before we end the podcast, What recommendation would you give to CVCs who are just getting started? What would you recommend them to pay attention now they have started and they're in the game, but they need to be A, B, or C?
When I made the switch from being an entrepreneur and operator to being an investor, a mentor of mine, a VC who had been very successful over 20 years, observed that sometimes your strongest relationships are across firms rather than within your own firm, particularly when you're on a board together or working with co-investors on a company. And so I'd encourage listeners who are on a cap table, who are co-invested with investors that they admire or respect, to seek them out and look for mentorship outside of the firm. I'm sure there are great mentors within the firm, but finding mentors outside the firm that are exceptional investors, seasoned investors, this is a craft that takes decades to learn. And it takes 8 or 10 years for these cycles to play out. So the learning cycles are very long. Finding those individuals on the cap table or in the boardroom and seeking out mentorship is very valuable.
I love this golden nugget. And I think it touched on the fact that this is nearly an apprenticeship. It takes time to build the craft and to master it, and mentorship from people who have done it before and learn from mistakes and failures is very, very helpful. So Jeff, thank you so much for your time. There was many golden nuggets. And for the audience, remember, there is a book to buy, and this is going to be really good for you as an investor to know where to invest in AI, but also to pick the right entrepreneurs.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.